Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week, we're celebrating love of country. But of course, we're not just talking about the 4th of July. A thrilling World Cup is on as well, and everyone in our office has been enjoying cheering on their country, whichever it is. But often, the most patriotic citizens are also the ones who are the most critical. People like Yuani Sanchez. Sanchez is a computer scientist, writer, activist, and blogger who has stirred up a lot of controversy in her home country of Cuba. In 2007, she started a blog, which is no small feat in a place where an hour of time spent online can cost as much as 2 weeks' pay. Her blog, called Generación Y, or Generation Y, focuses on the Cuban government's limits on free speech, its inability to create proper technological infrastructure, and its deliberate control over information. Recently, I met Yuani Sanchez in Chicago, where we talked about her issues with Cuban policies, the development of her now infamous blog, and the steps her country must take in order for it to become the Cuba she was always promised.
Help us to understand what the position should be for many people in the United States who don't quite see the right political angle. They might have believed at some point in some of the values of the revolution, healthcare, education, you know, equality. But they worry that if they criticize Cuba, that somehow they're going to be seen as something that they may not feel that they are, conservative, right wing, et cetera, et cetera. So what do you say to people who are trying to manage how they should approach Cuba at this particular moment in time and approach you?
First, I want to say that I'm completely against those types of classifications that have been established in the universal image of what Cuba is. Pro-Fidel Cubans versus the refugees who were labeled worms after they fled. That labeling is the core of Castro's Cuba. It has been the official propaganda that has divided the country, labeling some with glorious epithets and others with dismissive epithets. That shouldn't be the case, because you'd assume that in any nation, you can have whatever political beliefs you want. So to be accused of being unpatriotic is for them to take away your nationality and push you toward exile. They unnationalize you. So I'm not going to accept the categories of the Castro regime. I have to tell you that every citizen has the duty to criticize, because only criticism makes a society better. So here's what happens. In Cuba, there are a lot of myths and stereotypes that have been exported. For example, education. When someone complains in Cuba about the lack of liberty and the lack of a free press or about the censorship of information, they're told essentially, shut up, because in the end, you've been educated by that same system for free. The Cuban education system that the world likes to talk about, it was a system that existed in the years of Soviet support, where the Cuban government would construct small schools everywhere to have a matriculation of students and a small group of teachers financed by the Kremlin. Imagine a sickly man who is hungry but who has a buff Arnold Schwarzenegger arm. It's totally disproportionate. That's how the education system was in Cuba. It was a showcase that was financed with Russian rubles. When that funding was cut, the showcase ended, and the education system in Cuba fell into an abysmal state, which is what we live in now. Classrooms with little infrastructure, a lack of proper textbooks, fierce political indoctrination, and an intense imposition of ideology that's been here since the beginning of that education system. Teachers are underpaid. A Cuban teacher makes less than $20 a month. At the most, they make 30. And so that has caused a mass exodus of teachers to other professions, including prostitution. Kids who from 8 a.m. to midday are in front of a television getting teleclasses because there aren't enough teachers to go around. If there is a teaching infrastructure across the country, that infrastructure is in a great deal of deterioration, both ethically and in terms of labor force.
How did you understand that blogging was what you needed to do, not to write a novel, not to write a screenplay, not to write a book? When did you understand, no, it's blogging?
More than coming to see myself as a blogger or a digital journalist, in my case, it was more so out of necessity. the need to narrate my reality. For instance, a question was tormenting me. Where was the Cuba I was promised? Because since I was a child, I was promised a Cuba that has never been realized. So that need to ask and say and really criticize, I knew that I would never fulfill those needs through official forms of media. No one was going to give me a microphone or a minute on the radio or television, and much less a space in the official newspaper. So thanks to the combination of my love of writing, but also my love for technology, I realized I could fuse the two passions of my life, and in 2007, I started a blog. The blog was for me not a decision, but a necessity.
Al blog no me llegó un proceso de decisión, sino de necesidad.
Where did you learn to be so fearless? I mean, literally, do you remember a moment when you faced fear and you just said, I'm going to go for it? And who taught that to you?
Honestly, I think I owe the real drive to my son. I have a 19-year-old son named Theo, and Theo asks many questions. In 2003, when Theo was 8, Cuba experienced what's called La Primavera Negra, or the Black Spring. That moment was hard for all of us because the Cuban government was taking advantage of the war between the United States and Iraq by imprisoning 75 independent journalists and activists. During that moment, a great friend of ours was imprisoned, Adolfo Fernández Sainz, who was an independent journalist. He was close to the family. Theo called him Uncle Adolfo. And so there was a moment where we had to tell Theo that Uncle Adolfo was in prison. And like any other kid, he asked why. Reinaldo, trying to find a positive explanation for a horrible story, said, well, Adolfo is a brave man. And Theo immediately responded, oh, so you guys are cowards because you're free. That's my son. And with a son like that, we can't keep quiet.
No lo puedo creer.
Es tremendo.
What does he dream of? ¿Y él qué sueña? ¿Qué quiere ser?
Lo más interesante es que él pertenece a una generación que ya está viviendo el postcastrismo, ¿no?
The most interesting thing is that he belongs to a generation that is, in a way, already living in a postcastro world. It is a generation that has developed an interesting mechanism that, I swear, one day science will have to study. His generation has developed selective hearing, and they feel like they're a part of the whole world, and their focus is on the outside. That all around the world, this generation has developed selective hearing, and in general, they love technology. They play video games, they keep up with soccer, they have managed to leave behind the past that my generation is still dragging along. So my dream for him is not only that he develops into a more globally minded person, but also into a person that reaches beyond just this closed bubble of family and friends, a person who can successfully navigate a global society. And I dream that he can live in a normal country, a place where he can scream a phrase on the street corner and where he can have a political opinion without being censored.
What do you say to people in the United States and other places who just feel like they're getting sucked in by technology, that they're becoming less productive because of technology, that they're wasting time because of technology, as opposed to what you see technology, which is this complete liberation?
Sí, bueno, me encantaría que existiera en Cuba también un movimiento así porque eso significaría que
I would love it if we had that in Cuba. If there was a movement like that, because it would mean that we've had years and years of internet access. In Cuba's case, we are first trying to make technology a right while respecting our privacy. Having that ability or possibility to be plugged in 24 hours a day or have a Twitter account or simply choose not to use their mobile device. Our situation in Cuba today is far from being like that. Today, it's about getting internet connectivity in our homes, which is nearly impossible. We're still living in a rudimentary state of existence here. We have to solve that problem first.
Can you compare your experience around race and racism in Cuba versus your experience around race and racism, let's say, now in the city of Chicago or in the rest of anywhere else that you might have visited in the United States?
Bueno, tengo que decir que llevo pocos días en Chicago con un programa muy apretado dentro de instituciones, ¿no?
Well, I have only spent a few days in Chicago with a very tight itinerary, but I have seen that this is a very segregated city, and there are places in the city where different sectors of the population, different racial groups, don't really interact. In Cuba, according to the law and institutionally, we don't have racism. That's what we export to the world. world. Or at least that's what the official media portrays. The truth is that the black population is in a terrible economic situation for many reasons, primarily because emigration has been a white emigration. The people who left Cuba and now send money back to their family, those people are mostly white. You have to understand, in Cuba we have two currencies, the national peso and the convertible currency, which is far more valuable, and the black population feels like they don't get the economic benefit of the convertible currency, which is necessary to live. Whether you have convertible currency or not is the question of the day. If you have it, you get access to stores with more items. It is the difference between using toilet paper or not, drinking milk or not, the difference between eating bread that day or not. There is a huge unofficial institutional prejudice that prevents the black population from rising to decision-making positions, positions of power, administrative positions, jobs with better salaries. The same exists in schools. Even though education is for all and opportunity is for all, it is clear that a 14-year-old black boy has economic imperatives that push him to drop out of school at an early age to start working. More than 90% of people in prison are black. These are official statistics. The majority of the prostitutes in the street are mixed race or black. Economically, they are very marginalized. On the other hand, the official Cuban discourse instills fear in them. They are told that if there is a change, a democratic process in Cuba, you will return to that terrible time before January 1959. They are under the threat of a return to a model that cannot exist anymore because it's in the past. They aren't allowed to associate themselves freely. That is a huge difference between Cuba and Chicago. I see groups of people who fight for equality, integration. In Cuba, all of that is illegal. To talk about it is taboo. Since the official propaganda says it has been eradicated, to speak of it again, you fall into the category of enemy of the state.
You can find a link to Yoani Sanchez's blog on our website, latinousa.org.